education. I've been participating in BASN events over the years, and it's really great to see everybody here and the network thriving. Thank you, Erica. Okay, so snakes occupy an uneasy place in human cultures, sometimes vilified for the fear and revulsion they evoke, and often killed for their skins or as perceived threats. But alongside fear, there's also reverence. In some cultures, snakes symbolize fertility, strength, and other positive qualities. And increasingly, snake fanciers keep them as pets. Aesthetic values and disvalues are critical to these human-snake interactions and may both ground destructive relationships to snakes and relations that benefit snakes, enabling them to flourish. This morning, I explore the variety of our aesthetic responses to snakes, specifically negative aesthetics, fascination, and beauty. My principal aim is to work toward how we might understand the case for herpetological beauty, thereby gaining a better theoretical grasp of aesthetic engagement with them, but one that doesn't rely upon the approach which is known as positive aesthetics, which argues that all of wild nature is beautiful. The approach I'm taking here is largely philosophical. At points, I will turn to some empirical evidence, some empirical studies to try to think through our human aesthetic and emotional responses to snakes. So just an outline of the talk to get us started. A bit of science, culture, and then working through these different categories of aesthetic experience of snakes, and finishing with notions of ecological beauty and positive aesthetics. In the short time I've been trying to get to know snakes, I've dipped into these into various kinds of discussions, both scientific and more broadly cultural discussions. I've read accounts of experiences by reptile and field biologists and various studies about the empirical psychology of our responses to snakes, and again, different ways in which snakes and human culture interact. Largely, the herpetological accounts show reverence, respect, and concern for snakes and their protection. Though, of course, scientists, too, are involved in collecting and killing. I've not managed to speak to a herpetologist yet, or to any other snake practitioners with intimate knowledge, but I hope to do so before long. I've only ever handled a snake once, a small garter snake in the backyard when I was a kid, but I have seen more recently rat snakes and other species when I spent time in the US, primarily Florida and the Southwest. In the UK, it's three species, the adder, the grass snake, and the smooth snake, none of which I've encountered, although Jonathan apparently has experienced a grass snake.
About 100 yards over in the
back. 100 yards over here. And I will show a short clip of adder behavior later on in the talk. Harvey Lillywhite, a herpetologist, I think sums up the situation between humans and snake species pretty well. He says, "Since childhood, I have marveled at the sleek form, rich colors, and absolutely intriguing behaviors of snakes. Having no limbs, these reptiles possess incredible stealth, grace, and beauty. They exhibit a wonderful capacity for actions that amuse, strike, startle, or evoke intense curiosity. They have evolved colors and patterns that awaken the artist, and they have inspired mythical reverence and respect for many cultures. They persistently survive, and yet they are perhaps the most maligned group of vertebrates, misunderstood by far too many humans who carry out death sentences at every opportunity." Snakes are unlike those familiar mammals to humans, being without fur or feathers, making them much more difficult to engage with through sympathy or empathy. They do not sing like birds, meow or roar like felines, or bark and howl like canids. Snakes are limbless tetrapods who, through various forms of locomotion, move over ground, desert, up trees, or through water. They have eyes that do not blink, scales, a darting tongue, and ears that we cannot see. Their sense of sight and smell is diminished in comparison to humans, but they possess great tactile capacity, sensing their environment through feeling vibration and picking up prey through pheromone trails and other chemical signals received through tongue slicking. As cold-blooded or ectothermic, they regulate their temperature through external sources. Some snakes lay eggs, while others give live birth, for example, adders. In terms of other behavior, their movement is extraordinary from a human perspective, but quite natural for a limbless animal. Their concertina motion, sprints, sidewinding, as we see in desert environments, swimming, gliding, and climbing, or scansorial movement, all describe these forms of their locomotion. So this is for Jonathan. Snakes do make sounds, apart from those generated by moving through leaves, sand, or water. The sounds produced by rattlesnake species are well known. Lily White notes that, quote, people generally find rattlesnakes to be noisy animals, but many folks do not appreciate the elegant qualities of the rattle and the tail that shakes it, end quote. Snakes also hiss, of course, and even a growl in the king cobra. Lily White further describes snake sounds in this way. He says, quote, the sounds vary from low guttural noises like bellows and growls to sharper sounds resembling escaping steam or noisy gusts of air escaping through a tube. In the hiss, there is generally simple acoustic structure with little frequency or amplitude modulation and little or no temporal patterning. In terms of other kinds of interactions with snakes, beyond those driven by scientific understandings, we find that human-snake relationships reach very far back in time and across practices and cultures. Snakes appear in cave paintings, in the oldest art from some 30,000 years ago. Serpents symbolize peace and healing to early Greeks and Romans, and we see that reflected in the entwined snake symbol, which represents the medical profession. In the Bible, we find Eve's temptation by the serpent in the Garden of Eden. In literature, we have Milton's Paradise Lost in Book 1, where he says, say first, what cause moved our parents in that happy state, favored of heaven so highly, to fall off from their creator and transgress his will? The infernal serpent. He it was whose guile stirred up with envy and revenge deceived the mother of mankind. Today, we find snakes handled as part of some fundamentalist Christian services in the southeastern U.S. The snake is a creator of human beings, common in Aboriginal art and mythology of Australia. Snakes are frequently revered, again, as symbols of fertility. In Haiti, for example, the rainbow serpent. In ancient Mesoamerican culture, we find the snake deity Kukulkan, or Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, with a well-known or famous Mayan ruins showing carvings of a mythical plumed serpent with rattles on its tail. And again, for some Mesoamerican cultures, the serpent deity represented fertility. This is an interesting image. I've not been to the temple, but what you see here and what's famous is during the equinox, the way the light shines onto this serpent here makes it appear as if it's descending the temple. In Asia, of course, snakes are deeply entangled in human life. Snake charming with cobras is an old practice in India, and we also see cobras in religious contexts. For example, and I couldn't get an image of this, but it's a really interesting one. The Buddha in the temple at Mount Popa in Myanmar is sheltered under a multi-headed king cobra. Some human snake practices are now in decline, such as snake charming, due to wildlife protection laws, while other kinds of practices driven by human interests continue in the form of snake hunters and collectors, snake fanciers and hobbyists, reptile biologists and herpetologists. There are amateurs and professional herpetologists, many of whom enjoy herping. So there's plenty of, all you have to do is look at the internet to find all these herping websites and field herping and so on. Snakes have been and continue to be valued, but also used and abused, caged in terrariums in the exotic pet trade, in zoo exhibits, valued in some communities for killing rodents, skinned dead or alive for their economic value, killed and persecuted at snake roundups. Some species of snakes pose a threat to new communities. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there are thousands of deaths from snake bite every year. In light of all these practices and knowing the lowly status often attributed to them, how do we protect snake species, which have been in serious decline due to habitat loss and fragmentation, persecution, climate change, and other factors? Where does aesthetics fit into this question? Being so very different from humans tends to make snakes, as one scientist has put it, biophilically challenged. As will be true for reptiles generally, snakes can be difficult to love, being so unlike our own species and so unlike charismatic animals. In this part of the talk, I consider fear in response to snakes before then moving on to thinking on negative aesthetics. Fear is a common cross-cultural response to snakes, and one reason they are generally placed low on animal preference scales. Snake phobia, or ophiophobia, is among our most common human phobias. For people without diagnosed ophiophobia, fear and repulsion are said to be caused by biological and evolutionary factors triggering a fear response, as well as cultural biases. Snakes are feared in many human societies because of a perceived threat, but there's also evidence showing that other primates, exhibit fear of snakes, even snakes known not to be venomous. These kinds of responses underlie what environmental psychologists call negativistic attitudes toward snakes. It is interesting and regretful that snakes themselves seem to be maligned in this kind of research, often chosen as one of a set of animals used to gauge people's emotional responses. For example, in Myers et al. Study of emotional responses to zoo animals, gorilla, okapi, and several snake species were used, with the snakes purposefully chosen because they are commonly known to cause revulsions. Also, Prokop et al. Suggests that there is little research done on attitudes towards snakes apart from examining the fear response, though there are some studies out there in trying to look at beauty and cross-cultural responses to, which focus, for example, on Boyd snakes. The biological aspects of our responses to snakes do make it tricky to understand our aesthetic interactions with them. How might we grasp responses that are biologically based, the apparent evolutionary adaptation of our aversion to snakes, and those that are based more in the senses, imagination, and emotion, where we make what I would call aesthetic judgments? What can we meaningfully say about snake ugliness and snake beauty beyond biology or adaptation? So let's see how we can try to answer this question, and again, to do so through thinking through initially some negative aesthetic categories. Ugliness and disgust are related concepts commonly used to describe negative aesthetic responses. In our everyday language, as well as discussions in the history of aesthetics, beauty and ugliness are placed at opposite poles, with beauty as the exemplar of aesthetic value and ugliness as the exemplar of aesthetic disvalue. While philosophers have discussed beauty as involving qualities such as order, harmony, the pleasant and enjoyable, ugliness keeps company with disorder, deformity, decay, disease, and the messy, spoiled, lumpy, slimy, raspy, and qualities of that nature. Why are snakes considered so unattractive? We've seen some of the biological evidence for our aversion to snakes. Moving beyond this, I would argue that it is their appearing disordered or disharmonious, specifically in comparison to what humans are accustomed to finding appealing, such as companion animals and birds. Their difference from our own species makes too sharp a contrast. As Rudolf Arnheim puts it, in terms of trying to understand the concept of ugliness, he says, a clash of uncoordinated orders, when each of its parts has an order of its own, but these orders do not come together, and thus the whole is fractured. While a particular snake species itself seems functionally ordered for the suborder Serpentis, perfectly made for moving across surfaces without limbs, for example, it appears disordered or incoherent to ourselves in comparison to human species or other species, which we can much more comfortably anthropomorphize. That is perhaps an ugly or not so ugly snake. As I see it, the concept of ugliness lies on a spectrum, with disgust as its strongest form. Disgust, a basic emotion, is associated with the disgust facial response studied by many psychologists. Now, while snakes may be considered disgusting by some people, we should be careful not to reduce disgust to revulsion. Some forms of disgust do involve a bona fide aesthetic response with some degree of perceptual attention and interest. Philosopher Carolyn Korsmeyer has developed a view of aesthetic disgust in opposition to the disgust as revulsion idea. Her fine-grained analysis shows that disgust is not reducible to a mere visceral or emotional reaction, but has affective, perceptual, and cognitive components, as we find with other kinds of aesthetic response. Aesthetic disgust is subject to what she describes as cognitive monitoring. That is, it involves affective appraisals which integrate external information, shaping our response in various ways. Think about the adder in this respect. I agree with Korsmeyer that disgusting things can be objects of appreciative regard and understanding. And I would argue that some of our negative reactions to snakes may be described in this way. Essentially, the value of her idea lies in opening up at least some conceptual space for even negative aesthetic responses having some kind of content, which again means not just a sort of account of disgust, which is looking away, recoiling, or running away. From the human standpoint, disgust has existential force, with the fear of death associated with snakes suggesting, and this is Korsmeyer's words, not just destruction, but reduction of the noblest life to decaying organic matter in which all traces of individuality are obliterated. In some of our aesthetic encounters with snakes, whether on the nature trail, in the places we forage for food, or as the powerful serpents of myths, through disgust we may be offered a glimpse into human culture and its limits, a glimpse that is deflating, reminding us of how vulnerable we are. Ugliness and aesthetic disgust enable us to experience a range of complex emotions and to grapple with more difficult aesthetic qualities and situations. Negative aesthetic experiences have an existential charge, which can help us to more fully grasp where we stand in relation to things rather different from human selves. Setting aside in theory, or avoiding in practice, more challenging forms of aesthetic engagement, even at their extremes, would create, I think, a gap in the range of meaningful interactions with nature which lie beyond the realm of easy appreciation. Besides ugliness and disgust, the natural sublime can also have this kind of effect. And though this aesthetic category probably only applies to some human-snake interactions, for example, witnessing a Burmese python devouring a deer much larger than itself, where it does occur, it can, I believe, teach us something about humility. Perhaps, in turn, such humility can garner respect, or some kind of other regarding moral attitude. Now, I've considered negative aesthetics with regard to snakes, and I've tried to show that even these kinds of interactions can offer us some kind of value. Let me look at fascination, which certainly is part of aesthetic engagement. We're enthralled by animal behavior, human and otherwise. Consider the experience of various bird displays in breeding behavior, such as swans, grebes, displays in flight, and so on. Snakes, too, are fascinating, not only their difference to ourselves, but also in their behaviors. So consider some of these examples. This is the ringhole snake in southern Africa, flattening itself. Here it is playing dead. Here again, a kind of behavior that you'll be familiar with. Certainly, here's a spectacled cobra doing a hood spread, which involves a form of inflating or flattening the neck or body. And you can look online for lots of YouTube videos, which will show you some pretty incredible behavior. But I'm going to show you a Bill Oddie video to bring things closer to home. Hopefully this will all work, and the sound is somewhere happening.
Right away, let me say, the only reason to be a snakeophobe in Britain is that you wouldn't want to be bitten by an adder. You almost certainly wouldn't die, but it is the poisonous snake. It's our only one. By and large, though, I don't think people who can't abide snakes hang around to identify them, so what is it that they can't stand about snakes at all? It seems it's partially what a snake hasn't got that bothers them. No fur, no visible ears, no eyelids, no legs, no real tail. In fact, it's more like one long tail. One of my daughters described it as a tube of death. Cold-blooded reptiles they may be, but during the mating season, adders put on one of nature's most impressive spectacles. This display isn't one of affection. It's a battle of male dominance to win the heart of a female. That's the love story worth watching.
Okay, so again, a very nice example of some snake behavior much closer to home. So what does this tell us about fascination? For cases of animals which do not fit into more conventional ideas of beauty, in animals or in other humans, the behaviors of less appealing species can in fact add aesthetic value. And fascination, importantly, is aesthetically relevant, not primarily about seeking knowledge. Stan Gottlobich, a philosopher who writes in environmental aesthetics, I think articulates very nicely how fascination fits into aesthetic value. And I have a long quote here, I should have it on the slide, but I don't. He says, "Unlike curiosity, the native fount of science, which impels us to rationalize, categorize, and explain experience, fascination neither needs nor seeks resolution or satiation, being neither a state of affective incompleteness, like wanting or wondering, nor a mechanism of self-corrective data processing, like seeing or hearing, which seek proper focus. Fascination is not directive, not a goal-oriented state. Because of the sensory and affective complexities of aesthetic experience, fascination stands proxy for a cluster of terms, all of which accent a powerfully personal bond, analogous to affection, that develops in aesthetic experience. If aesthetic experience is a complex form of sensory affective captivation, it cannot be detached, dispassionate, cool, aloof, impersonal, distant, analytical, clinical, in charge. These states dampen, if not inhibit, the unprompted attraction and involvement afforded by fascination." So, in looking at these different kinds of behaviors, fascination becomes an especially relevant aesthetic category. And in the ascription of any of these categories, ugliness, disgust, fascination, this will depend, of course, on the nature of our engagement with a snake, what the snake is doing, what kind of snake it is, what it is we perceive or attend to, and what we bring to the experience in terms of our own particular cultural and personal background, values, imagination, emotional state, biases, phobias, and so on. That's the link, another adder. Okay, so on to herpetological beauty. My understanding of beauty, which I've discussed elsewhere, describes an experience which emerges through a relationship between perceiver and perceived. This relational notion of aesthetics is theorized quite comprehensively in the 18th century heyday of aesthetic theory, and even by the likes of Kant, who is frequently, and incorrectly in my view, held up as a representative of a distance observational aesthetic. We find in many 18th century writers, aesthetic value is emerging from judgments which are grounded in the subject that is perceptually, emotionally, and imaginatively engaged with phenomena which range from the natural world to the arts. As such, the conditions and context of the perceived will matter a great deal, as well as different forms of attention or framing. Much of our aesthetic attention is selected, so we may focus on one feature of our environment, perhaps the sky above our heads, or we may select close-up perusal of an exquisite leaf shape or a tiny ladybird. Other situations capture our attention, just imposing themselves on us, a thunderclap during a rainstorm, or from the corner of the eye, a glimpse of a snake silently moving into the undergrowth from a path in front of us. Sometimes natural beauty will be formal beauty, linked chiefly to the multisensory perception of formal properties, arrangements of forms, patterns, structures, shapes, and colors. At other times, it may involve expressive or imaginative qualities, more richly connected into imagination and emotions in the perceiver. And of course, any aesthetic situation may involve all these dimensions, as well as forms of knowledge. Now, how might we find beauty in snakes? Much of the beauty we do find in snakes is, according to some studies, related to formal aesthetic qualities such as shapes, patterns, combinations of colors, and textures. For those of us not intimately acquainted with snakes, through spending a lot of time with them and thus getting a closer appreciation of their behavior, formal qualities will be largely what we attend to. Indeed, for us here today, our acquaintance is merely visual in terms of the slides I've been showing you and some of the sounds in the video. And this is also true of various psychological studies, which tend to use photographs or viewing through terrariums. Informal beauty, and here I'm just showing a few examples of what I'm talking about, really, if we're thinking about formal beauty. They're almost like snake portraits, really. In formal beauty, we find positive aesthetic value. And I don't see that as a bad thing, even if it represents a rather narrow form of aesthetic engagement with the world. In this case, the perceiver is certainly abstracting away from the snake as a living, breathing animal, and as an individual, to appreciate formal, expressive, and sensory features of his or her appearance. When it comes to snakes, aesthetic engagement that is limited to formal beauty is not always an impoverished aesthetic, despite its apparent superficiality. Well, for animals that are feared, such abstraction from elements of real or perceived danger may be the only avenue for finding snake value in terms of aesthetic value. Also, that formal beauty may be all that is really available to many of us through pictures or via YouTube to watch or listen to behavior. It can be quite revealing nonetheless, the visual. Viewing a sea snake's sleek body and effortless swimming, they appear incredibly graceful and elegant in comparison to a human or a dog. We may also experience snakes as beautiful by quite purposefully working toward putting aside our fear or revulsion and making the effort to focus our attention of aesthetically relevant features such as formal beauty, expressions of beauty through behavior. Sorry, let me start that again. That's not making any sense. We may also experience snakes as beautiful by quite purposefully working toward putting aside our fear or revulsion and making the effort to focus our attention of aesthetically relevant features such as formal beauty, expressions of beauty, through behavior, imaginative reflection on snake beauty, and the ways that snakes, again, have been represented in the visual arts and other arts in human cultures. Where are we now? Oh, good. These forms of aesthetic appreciation have a place in encouraging positive feeling, as long as it goes hand in hand with a moral attitude. Of course, the aestheticization of snakes is a real danger, where snake collecting, driven often by the beauty of a particular species, has an impact on the decline of a population, as lamented by Bruce Means with regard to this species, the eastern indigo snake, but also the Appalachia king snake. And the beauty of some snakes is also their demise in the snakeskin market, for example. I've suggested some of the ways we might find snakes to be ugly, fascinating, and beautiful, but so far I've avoided thinking more deeply about the role of knowledge in our aesthetic experiences. How does that knowledge shape those experiences, and what promise might there be for aesthetic experience deeply informed by knowledge in terms of increasing respect for and our protection of snakes? I'd like to begin thinking about this notion of ecological beauty with a couple accounts from herpetologists. So the first one is from Bruce Means, a herpetologist based in Florida who has a wide interest in reptiles. Late at night, after writing up my journal notes for the day, I slump down on the bed and click off the lights. A great and memorable day in my life comes to a close as a fine feeling of euphoria sweeps over me. I exult in the privilege I have been given to share a few moments lives of two large eastern diamondbacks. I relive in my mind the contrasting behaviors of the two snakes. Then, just as I am dozing off, Kathy punches me awake and complains of the faint, musky rattlesnake odor still clinging to my skin. She wants me, to get up and wash again. Getting up is the last thing I want to do. Besides, I kind of like the smell. Harry Green, another herpetologist, tells the story of students' prejudices slipping away as they experience rattlesnakes, or as he teaches them about their biological, cultural, and aesthetic aspects. But what about those But what about those who fear snakes or know little about them? Can they come to find them beautiful? Is there a route to aesthetically valuing snakes through scientific or other forms of knowledge? Here, the concept of ecological beauty is especially relevant. This is natural beauty characterized by wholeness, where the parts fit together harmoniously or with some kind of integrity. Ecological beauty encompasses death, disease, decay, ugliness, but these negative values are situated within a positive, harmonious whole, within an ecological narrative. Stephen Davies, a philosopher who's looked closely at evolutionary aesthetics, suggests the possibility that we may become, quote, so interested in the lives of snakes that the primitive fear response is inhibited, and we marvel to see the exquisiteness with which each species meshes with and enriches its environment. Environmental education is a promising route to appreciating snake beauty, but some of the empirical evidence shows that actual non-threatening interactions with snakes have potential to make more of a difference, that is, more effective than simply gathering new facts or knowledge. This means ideally handling snakes or otherwise interacting with them in order to enrich both knowledge and aesthetic appreciation. But this, of course, raises the ethical question of just how much interference with snakes ought to be encouraged. In educating people, what is the cost to snakes? Also, if we are serious in thinking that people ought to be brought round to loving snakes and caring for them, we need to be realistic. All the knowledge in the world may not change one's views, especially if living in a situation where snakes present a daily threat to livelihood. In those kinds of cases, of course, other avenues are needed, avenues which enable us to work out cohabiting without conflict. Philosophers have used the concept of ecological beauty to encompass all of our aesthetic experiences of nature, putting forward the idea that all of nature is beautiful or aesthetically good. They mean here minimally managed nature, the closest we might get to so-called wild nature. The idea, which has a historical basis, is now formulated as positive aesthetics. Positive aesthetics reflects ecological beauty insofar as it argues that, for example, ugliness, disease, predation, and so on in nature can be valued, ultimately, as beautiful when we are equipped with a full understanding of the ecological narrative at play. That is, we find beauty if our judgment is grounded in an understanding of the ecological processes of life and death at work. So again, it's a type of ecological beauty, which is then, in a sense, universalized. Is positive aesthetics the answer when it comes to herpetological beauty? Elsewhere, I've argued that although positive aesthetics is appealing for its ecological awareness, it fails to recognize the range of aesthetic qualities and associated values we do, in fact, find in nature, both negative and positive. While I do value environmental education, it is not desirable or possible to explain away our negative aesthetic encounters by framing them more holistically. The reasons for this relate to my understanding of the role of perception and the senses in aesthetic situations. Aesthetic valuing brings in all sorts of background knowledge, experiences, and biases, but ultimately, if we are in fact talking about aesthetic value or aesthetic situations, our attention is not directed at the science of ecological interactions. Those arguing for positive aesthetics will try to find beauty by providing an ecological explanation about how a fresh kill provides food for a black vulture, or rotting carcass for maggots. However, because our aesthetic judgments are anchored in perception, we may simply find it difficult to sense and feel anything but ugliness in those kinds of experiences. To accept positive aesthetics or hold the position that all natural beauty can be explained through narrow ecological beauty disregards the diversity of aesthetic qualities in nature and the significance that more challenging forms of aesthetic experience may have for deepening meaning and values within human-non-human interactions. Snakes are beautiful and fascinating for many, but also frightening and ugly. The position I'm taking here is inspired to some extent by a progressive environmental ethics, which moves away from a sole emphasis on intrinsic value and toward an interest in how our relationships to environments shape our moral attitudes toward them. This shift in emphasis is marked by the recognition that many of our interactions with the natural world exist within more cultural contexts, such as rural and urban environments, rather than the distant wild. In these kinds of interactions, we may have more regular interactions with nature in ways that enable us to form meaningful relations. In recognizing the range of environmental values, particularly disvalue, Alan Holland makes a salient point that, quote, "the cheerful ascription of value does little to register the part played by the natural world in some of the grief, disappointment, sorrow, and failure that are among the most basic ingredients of a fully engaged, fully committed, and fully vulnerable human life." End quote. To build an account that extends beyond intrinsic value, Holland argues for the importance of meaningful relations as a unifying, quote, unifying concept that characterizes evolutionary and ecological relations as well as cultural ones. So, to conclude then, bringing the concept of meaningful relations into our aesthetic and ethical reflections can bring to light the significance of the range of our interactions across species and how they support moral action. This kind of approach promises a more complete and generous grasp of our meaningful engagement with snakes in terms of, again, the variety of aesthetic responses, ugliness, fascination, beauty, and other varieties.